title for this our first talk is Managing Weeds Sustainably, the Human Element. And George Griswold with the University of Arizona will talk with us. George, I'll give it over to you.
Thank you. Wave hands if you're watching me virtually and you can't hear what I'm saying. Also, if in the middle of my talk you want to ask a question, I'm happy to answer things midway through. I've got a lot of slides, so I'm going to go through these pretty quickly. This is Millay's Man with a Hoe, which also inspired Edward Markham's poem that talks about the person hoeing starting out bowed by the weight of centuries he leans, and then at the end stolid and stunned, the brother of the ox. And this is weed control from the beginning of agriculture until just the last half of the last century. So hoeing was what we did. You could see that herbicide use grew dramatically. This is corn acres ramping up. This is the percentage of acres being planted. So we went from very few acres to almost all acres receiving herbicide treatments for corn. Also a similar story for cotton and soybeans. So from the early 50s until the mid-80s, there's a dramatic change in the use of herbicides in U.S. agriculture. So herbicides went from being used on only a small share of corn, cotton, and soybean acres to being applied on nearly 100% of acres. The growth on wheat acres is slower, but now it exceeds about 70%. And so I think one thing people don't realize that most pesticides used today in the United States are actually herbicides. That insecticide use has actually declined while herbicide use has increased. The other big recent development is the rise of genetically modified herbicide-tolerant crops, especially those that are resistant to glyphosate. And we've had a widespread, rapid crop adoption of these genetically modified crops and a substitution of glyphosate for other herbicides. So the major effect is not so much increasing herbicide use, but substituting glyphosate for older compounds. And you could see the rise of pounds of glyphosate acres with the percent of acres in herbicide-tolerant soybeans tracking up together, and you could see pounds of other herbicides per acre going down. And you see a similar story here for cotton. Now, when these products first came out, there were some distinctive environmental benefits. Glyphosate had lower acute mammalian toxicity and other beneficial characteristics relative to the compounds they replaced. There's also evidence that glyphosate-resistant crop adoption complemented increased adoption of conservation tillage. And this is a study done by Justin Gardner and Gerald Nelson that's representative, looking at how basically environmental exposure, mammalian toxicity actually went down as a result of the glyphosate-resistant crop adoption. This is work I've done with colleagues looking at basically how the diffusion of herbicide-resistant cotton encouraged conservation tillage and vice versa. And there's a whole variety of different environmental benefits from conservation tillage. So at first, this technology in a lot of respects was viewed quite rightly as environmentally beneficial. Now, a problem with using herbicides is that a particular mode of action is an exhaustible resource. The more you use a mode of action today, the sooner weeds are going to evolve resistant to it. There's also an issue of if weeds are highly mobile, then managing resistance and the development of resistance of particular weed species is a common pool resource. It's kind of like overdrafting groundwater. Everybody who's over an aquifer knows that the more water they pump, the less water there's going to be in the aquifer, and the water table is going to go down. That said, if they think all their neighbors are going to pump anyway, they're going to pump too. And you can have a tragedy of the commons. We can have a similar thing going on with herbicide resistance, where people realize individually, collectively, everybody has an interest in preserving the efficacy of the herbicide, but individually, you may think that what you do isn't going to have a big enough effect, or your neighbors are going to swamp any kind of conservation you might do. So here's the adoption of genetically engineered crops in the United States. HD stands for herbicide tolerant, and the BT or the insect-resistant BT crops, and you could see really rapid adoption over a small period of time. Now, we've also had an increase in glyphosate-resistant weeds worldwide that's also shot up. Now, the glyphosate-resistant weeds are not the product of the genetically modified crops per se. There's nothing about the genetic technology that creates resistance problems in and of itself. Rather, what happened was the adoption of genetically modified varieties led to a dramatic reduction in the diversity of weed control tactics. And that was the problem, the reduced diversity. We had an increased reliance on chemical control relative to non-chemical control, and the chemicals that we were using were less diverse, and there's more reliance on a single mode of action. So you can hear, this is glyphosate kilograms of active ingredient as a percentage of total herbicide active ingredients applied, and you could see it ramping up dramatically for soybeans particularly, but also for cotton, somewhat less so for corn. Again, if you look at herbicide applied to corn by herbicide family and mechanism of action, the phosphinic acid herbicide family is glyphosate. You could see that shooting up, and again, going up for cotton, and again, going up very dramatically for soybeans. At the same time, what I'm showing you is all data from USDA's ARMS survey, and so that's why the bars are a little sporadic. It depends on when USDA does the analyses. But pre-emergence weed control has gone down. Cultivation for weed control has gone down. Now, there's a whole host of best management practices that people can adopt and that have been encouraged by industry, universities, commodity groups to delay resistance. And voluntary adoption's been promoted using kind of the traditional extension model. But adoption's been spotty and insufficient. This graph, this kind of radar graph, shows the percent of growers adopting these best management practices always or often. And if you go around that outer circle, you can see the different types of practices. And as you get toward the rim, you have higher adoption. So ideally, what you would like is those red, green, and blue lines to be along the outer perimeter. And what you see instead is that adoption rates for three practices, in particular using different modes of action, supplemental tillage, cleaning equipment, are pretty low. And the differences aren't very much across crops, so it isn't so much a crop-specific issue, it's a practice issue where people aren't adopting. Another issue here is this is the total number of best management practices growers are adopting often or always, and basically you can see as the number of BMPs adopted goes up, that's along the bottom axis, the percentage of growers doing it goes down. But I've circled that little area to indicate that most growers have been adopting most of the required practices most of the time. There's a problem with this most strategy. It's just simply not good enough. If someone told you that most people packing your parachute follow most of the recommended packing procedures most of the time, you're not going to be very confident getting in a plane and jumping out. And this is also a survey of extension and other ag professionals about what they were seeing different people doing on the ground, and most of them were saying either less or much less of using a combination of control methods, crop rotation, annual rotation of herbicides, using multiple herbicides or tillage, that extension and other crop specialists were seeing in this particular survey a dramatic reduction in what people were doing. Again, here's the increase in unique herbicide-resistant weed cases for different crops. And then here's states with glyphosate-resistant weeds in 2000, 2003, 6, 9, 12, 14. And here's some estimates of the cost per acre. They vary widely. I think there's a very large number for Arkansas. Some of the larger numbers are involved if you have to actually resort to doing hand weeding. Okay, so how did we get here with this rapid resistance problem? A lot of people thought that glyphosate resistance was going to be unlikely. As an economist, fellow economist told me, why are you studying resistance? Because Monsanto has the patent, and they'll never let resistance happen to any of these crops. So why are you even studying this? This economic theory tells me that this can't possibly happen. Well, economists are often wrong. I know that. You guys know that. But, you know, so among economists also, they thought that, you know, growers, there was no common pool problem, i.e. that people thought that controlling weeds just on your own fields would be good enough so that growers would have private incentives to manage resistance. Now, growers don't really think that. Surveys of growers think that a lot of whether they have resistance weeds or not isn't entirely up to them. A lot of, in surveys, they say that the resistance often is beyond their control. It's animals, it's birds, it's custom machinery, it's their darn neighbors who aren't doing a good job managing their weeds. And that ends up mattering a lot. Also, growers, you know, historically have thought that a new technology was going to come right around the corner. Why have they believed this? Well, that's always been true. We've had resistance problems before, and industry's always come out with a solution. Okay, and here's a famous study by Bradshaw, Perspectives on Glyphosate Resistance, and I'm not going to go through the gory details of the text, but this is just summarizing the abstract. But it was just summarizing all the reasons why having resistance to glyphosate was highly unlikely to be duplicated in nature. That's a 1997 publication. In Weed Science, by 2001, Mark Van Gessel identified the crops within 3 years of using only glyphosate for weed control. In a continuous glyphosate-resistant soybeans system, glyphosate failed to control horseweed. So we went from, this can't possibly happen, to, it's happened. Here's a quote from Blue Oyster Cult. You have to always bring in the classics of literature. History shows again and again how nature points out the folly of men. It's a line from their song Godzilla. I don't know the classics, but I know classic rock. So what are barriers to BMP adoption? So again, we hear over and over again that the economics is a big barrier. That, you know, growers aren't going to do something if they can't make it work financially in their system. Another aspect are what growers, you know, what they believe and what their attitudes are about the technology. So this is from a summit that was held at the National Academy of Sciences a few years ago, and this is a quote from David Miller from the Iowa Farm Bureau. And he said, I believe the primary impediment is the near-term costs associated with implementation of best management practices to forestall the problem that may or may not develop at some unspecified time in the future. So that's a real challenge for crop specialists, extension specialists, to tell some grower that you have to do something that's going to reduce your profits today because it's going to avoid some problem that might happen at some point in the future. That's kind of a hard sell. Another story, quote from Webster and Sosnowski, is that farmers believe in a silver bullet. And so they think the factors hindering adoption of practices that would contribute to glyphosate stewardship are the belief that a new technology will be developed to solve the resistance and tolerance problems. And they also believe that resistance management strategies will be futile, because even if they adopt the strategies, you can see a Trekkie laughing in the background, that other people won't. So here's part of a study I had done with some colleagues at USDA, and this is looking at the annual gains to managing herbicide-resistant weeds. And this is based on a biological simulation model from representative farms with three different cropping systems in the Midwest. And this graph is a little hard to interpret. Basically, it's the kind of net gain per acre from adopting a resistance management proactive strategy as opposed to just trying to maximize today's profits and ignoring how your actions could affect resistance in the future. And again, here's a table of that data. and the annual profit gain from managing resistance over the long term, about a 20-year time horizon, is 17% for corn, about the same for corn-soybean rotation, and somewhat smaller for continuous soybeans. Okay. Now, another issue is what happens about neighbor resistance management. So what happens if your grower manages resistance, but the neighbor doesn't? And this is when you have a tragedy of the commons. So for those of you who've probably seen A Beautiful Mind, the whole idea of game theory that John Nash was a pioneer in developing is, how do different people act strategically? How are my actions going to depend on what my neighbors do, and vice versa? And imperfect information is important. How do you coordinate between your neighbors to try to control resistance collectively? And so here's a case of returns to managing resistance given your neighbor's behavior, and this is for corn. And so the row is whether or not you as a grower manage resistance, and the columns are whether your neighbor manages resistance or not. So the way to interpret it is, if you manage resistance and your neighbor does, your long-run payoff is $431.72 an acre. If you both ignore it, then your returns per acre are only going to average $49.60. So there's huge gains here of cooperation. Now, if your neighbor manages resistance, your best outcome is to also manage resistance in this particular case. Here, if your neighbor doesn't manage resistance, your best strategy still is to manage resistance. Given the biology of this problem, that your gains are higher if both of you manage resistance, but it also pays in this continuous corn situation. It's also true for the corn-soybean rotation. If you manage resistance, no matter what your neighbor does. For soybeans, we found a different issue, where there were gains if you both managed resistance, but if you tried to manage resistance but your neighbor didn't, there was hardly any gain at all. So whether or not you were going to bother managing resistance really was a function of what your neighbor did. Now, it still pays if you both do that, but whether you're going to benefit from that or not really depends on what you think your neighbors will do. Okay, so again, people historically in surveys have thought the spread of resistant weeds were the result of natural forces or their neighbors' behavior. So there's a belief in their own individual action has little effect on resistance. In the mid-2000s, there was really low awareness of how practices affected weed resistance, or the importance of rotating herbicides with different modes of action or using tank mixes. Again, surveys in the early 2000s found that people had very low concern about resistance. That's definitely changed in more recent surveys of growers. But growers have still maintained a somewhat high confidence that new products will be available. So what do we do now? We have cases where we have kind of rampant resistance problems. And historically, with these kind of common pool problems, there's, you have a top-down regulatory approach where the government says, okay, everybody has to adopt these practices, or everybody is only going to have access to these herbicides in particular years and particular applications. And so it's usually uniform standards that are set at a central level, and in environmental policy, they call this command and control. Now, one of the lessons from environmental economics is that a lot of command and control policies that have been done at the federal level, things like air pollution control, water pollution control, have been effective at dramatically improving air and water quality. If you look at measures of air and water quality in the 70s compared to now, they're much, much better. However, economic study after economic study has found that those improvements were achieved at much, much higher cost than they needed to be. And part of that problem was that there's been a tendency to have a one-size-fits-all approach to assigning what different people have to do to control the particular resource problem. So one thing we know from history is that this kind of top-down federal government command and control approach is very, very costly. Another thing with agriculture, it's very hard to monitor what people do on their fields. You're not going to go out and, you know, police people farm by farm. And if you started to have a lot of restrictions on what things are registered or not, again, agriculture is very location specific. So having a centralized type of top-down regulatory approach could be quite expensive. The other alternative has been what I call the buy and apply approach, where industry has been going out and, you know, here's a new product, and this is going to solve all your problems, and don't think about cropping systems, don't think about diversity of weed management. It's like, you have a new problem this year, this new compound is going to fix your today's problem. And there's this emphasis on the next silver bullet that's going to come out. Okay, now is plant breeding going to rescue us? So we have these new stack varieties coming out, and they're resistant to multiple herbicides. So this reduces the reliance on a single mode of action. And there's a possibility to do like optimal rotations of modes of actions. Farmers could switch up, do certain things in some years, lay off them in others. These new varieties are resistant to compounds that have been around for years. The good news about that is that we know a lot about the health and environmental effects of these compounds. There's now a new controversy about synergistic effects of using some of these in combination, but a lot of these compounds have been around for a long time, so we have a lot of information about their health and environmental impacts. The problem with relying on old compounds is that some weeds are already resistant to these compounds, and they're resistant to more than one of them. So stacking these traits is less effective if resistance is already a problem. So you know, you may have a weed, and you have different herbicides, and you have a tank mix, and you may think that one of the three is working. Well, if you already have resistance to two of the compounds in the tank mix, you have a false sense of security. And again, we're still relying on old mechanism of actions, and the more we use them, eventually we're going to have resistance faster. Now here's the introduction time of new herbicide sites of action, and you could see that it was kind of a steady growth of those. And then I just chop off the end of this graph. We haven't had a new mode of action in more than 25 years. Again, talking to colleagues, sometimes they've been saying, we haven't had a new mode of action in 10 years. And I said, you realize you're citing 15-year-old sources when you say that we haven't had a new mode of action in 25 years. Now we have things that are resistant now to 2,4-D and dicamba, but those things have been around for a long time. There's nothing really new, and weeds have been exposed to them, so the scope for resistance is high. Now, growers are getting mixed signals from industry, depending on which venue you go to. You know, industry groups will tell you, you have to you have to be a good steward of the technology, and we have to do things to reduce resistance, and you should be adopting these best management practices. Now, the industry, they tend to be kind of divided into the marketing folks and the science folks, and sometimes what the marketing folks tell you is kind of different from what the science folks tell you. And I'm just going to say, to put this country simple, I'm not a biologist, but I don't know how you're going to eliminate weed resistance. Because this is like, okay, we're going to eliminate evolutionary biology. This is just really not scientific as far as I can go. And it's not a particularly responsible thing to say. And I found it disturbing in grower meetings now, because people really think that these new compounds are the silver bullet. Now, they're probably, they'll be effective stopgaps. They're going to have problems, but they'll be stopgaps, but that's all they're going to be. We're not going to eliminate weed resistance. Here's weed species resistant to multiple herbicide sites of action. Weed species resistance to one or more site of action. You can see that, you know, the weeds learn, the weeds evolve. The weeds are resistant to multiple sites within a population. It just grows. So if we're exposing them to more modes of action, those modes of action we're going to use up faster. Okay. Now another approach to either what I call top-down kind of centralized regulatory approach or a top-down private sector, just buy the stuff off the shelf and not don't think about what you're doing approach, is community-based approaches. And so the idea is that you have growers kind of collectively figure out how they're going to manage resistance. I was interested to see on this program there are a lot of other talks that had the word partnership in it. And I think that's an encouraging template. You know, we have lessons from other aspects in agriculture of ground water management programs, pest eradication programs, area-wide pest management programs, marketing orders for selling agricultural commodities. And what a lot of these have to have in common is that it's the growers that are really designing and implementing the rules. And so the for example, like insect pest eradication programs, the growers vote on the rules. Once they vote on the rules, then if enough growers, usually with the eradication programs, you have to have a majority of growers, and you have to have the growers that have a majority of acreage. So you don't have the big guys dominate the little guys, and you don't have the little guys dominate, you know, the big producers. So you have to get a critical mass of people on board to agree on what rules you're going to impose. Once you do that, you know, it's often usually the grower associations that enforce this. In the state of Arizona, we have some of these things for insect control. And there's state laws that growers are supposed to follow to manage particular insects. But it's really the grower groups that do the monitoring, the enforcement. The state government is in the background, but for the most part, the growers are policing themselves. Basically the government is there as a backstop to make sure that nobody cheats on the rules that the growers themselves identify. And I think it's a very different model than having something highly centralized. Okay, so to sum up, we've had a reduction in the diversity of weed control tactics that followed biotechnology adoption, and it led pretty predictably to widespread problems with herbicide-resistant weeds. Now we're kind of at a crossroads. Let's see. This is an older version of this slide. It's a greater federal regulation question mark. I think we're not going to see greater federal regulation of pesticides. I think now we're going to see very different regulation of pesticides. I think new herbicides are going to probably come on the market faster than they otherwise would have. And that's going to present challenges too, because extension people and crop advisors are going to have to, you know, deal with new things coming online faster and put in the field. Everybody's often frustrated when things are put in the field, you know, painfully slowly. But if things get in the field quickly, we're not going to know as much about the problems that they're going to create. I think we also have some false promises of silver bullet technologies. I mean, industry is always working on different things, but managing resistance is never going to be a problem that's going to go away. And so I think we have some choices of focusing on kind of centralized government control or just relying on industry to solve problems, to have growers kind of form locally based groups and institutions to conserve efficacy of herbicides. Okay. Now, one thing, if we don't do this, a thing to consider is that glyphosate's been called a once-in-a-lifetime herbicide. But if we go back to one of my very first slides, all the way back here, haven't been using herbicides all that long. So we haven't really been using them for a century yet. So the question is, I don't give anybody a heart attack. The question is, if we're not careful about this technology, the question, are herbicides a once-in-a-lifetime method of weed control? If we don't shepherd these things through, we're not necessarily going to have them. And how am I doing for time? I'm good. Like, how good? I can replace, actually. How much?
20 minutes.
One thing, I want to go back to this slide because I want to talk a little bit about, what's the role of extension people and crop consultants. This is great for academia, but if you're trying to convince a grower to do something, it's useless. They want to know how it's going to work. And even something like this, if you do it based on, here's a simulation model, with all these differential equations, and only one person knows how to run the model for a particular case. Again, that's great for academia. It's showing proof of concept. But if you want a grower in Iowa to actually literally bet the farm on a recommendation, you've got to, frankly, do a lot better than this. And we've tried to, come up with better ways of presenting this type of information, like how much you would save over, X years, and how, cumulatively, how much would you save, or how much more money would you make? And one of the things you see is that you kind of were upfront with people, that first part of all those lines, is it lose doing more aggressive resistance management? It loses money relative to not doing it in year one. So we're not going to sugarcoat it. It's like, this is going to cost you relative to what you'd other do. But then the idea is that you could see that in these particular models for the corn and corn-soybean rotation, it starts to pay for itself by year two and starts paying for itself on and on. For soybeans, it takes longer for it to pay for itself. But it might be 3-4 years. So trying to get growers to think a little bit longer term is hard, because when things are tight, people don't want to spend that extra money on an extra, residual. Like, why should I do that? And so we've tried to do things like sit them down and say, you got kids in college, you have money saved up, here, over the long run, like over, 10, 15 years, there's the college money right there. Or you're going to have a weed system that blows up on you. But again, a big challenge, I think, is working with growers, and you take something from academia and make it something that people can actually use. Even if you have more, crop budget examples, that probably isn't going to do it for most growers. We've discovered Mutu, I have a hard time pronouncing his name. It's Mutu Bagafa Thayanan. Indian crop scientist at Texas A&M University has been working with Jason Norsworthy developing what's called a Palmer Amaranth resistance management model. And growers can go in, and it's like it's Excel driven, and they can pop in different treatment strategies, and they can see how that would affect their payoffs over time on their particular farm. And you could pop in different assumptions about prices. You could pop in different assumptions about yields. And I think that's what really needs to get, further developed, because growers aren't going to look at something like this or something like that and make, expensive decisions. That growers have to go and say, well, here's my yields. What prices might be? So they can kind of play around with these things to see what the payoff is over the long term. And that's, again, a challenge for academics working with folks, who in consulting and advising and extension, is to not just doing something for a publication, but really, it's been a challenge for me, and it's been really, really educational to talk to crop consults and some of these National Academy of Science meetings we've been at. It's, you see all these people, they're like high-powered, brilliant folks, and we have some, very, down-home crop consultants, and they always have the best comments because they just deflate all us professorial types with reality, and we really, really need that. So, I would encourage you to work with, economists, because we have ways of putting together the numbers, but we also need to work with you to put the numbers in a way that's convincing to the people that you talk to. And I think as academics, that's a big challenge for us. Okay, I think I'm done talking. So if I can answer any questions people might have.
Any questions?
Okay. Thank you.